Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing Australian fantasy novelist Joe Spurrier. Welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
You've just released the second book in the Children of the Black Sun series, Black Sun Light My Way, and I noticed reading your bio on your website, you've got a bachelor's degree in science, and I wondered what attracted you to writing fiction and the fantasy genre in particular?
Well, the short answer is that I'm not necessarily very good at science because I tend to go with what makes an interesting story as opposed to what the evidence actually bears out, which people tend to find a bit of a problem in scientists. So I use these skills I got with that degree a lot in research, and I found they bore me really well when it comes to constructing a story. But ultimately, I just like playing with ideas more than really following the evidence.
No, that's fair enough. And were you a long-time fantasy reader? Is that the reason for the fantasy genre?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I started writing, started reading fantasy when I was about, I think I was about 11. My mum started giving me my first fantasy books. She was a teacher librarian, so we always used to read stuff together, and we would read the same books and talk about them. That's kind of where it all started, really.
So you can blame the teacher librarians of the world. You're talking to one right now, of course. Okay, your debut novel, which is Winter Be My Shield, garnered a number of nominations, and Aurealis and Norma came hemming, and I've certainly found it to be worthy of those nominations. Now, I don't think any author, not that any that I've spoken to, starts out with the expectation of awards or perhaps with even an expectation of being published. But when you sat down to write the draft of Winter Be My Shield, what was your expectation for the book?
I wanted to write the sort of book that I wanted to read. I really wanted to write a book people would just enjoy. They'd pick up for fun and just enjoy reading. And at the end of the go, that was a really great adventure. I always think of books as being a bit like taking a holiday, but it's a holiday that you can return to anytime you want. You can share it with your friends and you can come back to it 10 years down the track, and it might be the same as you remember, or you might be picking up different things that just didn't register with you the first time you read it. So really, I just set out to write a good story, and I'm getting a lot of the feedback I've gotten tells me that people think that's what I've come up with, so I'm very happy about that.
Talking a bit about gender now, I found Winter Be My Shield to be fairly gender balanced. Despite being ostensibly about the mage Sierra, there were quite a few well-defined secondary characters, and particularly Isidro. I wondered, was there a conscious decision to spread the focus, or was it, in particular with Isidro, was it just the investigation or exploration of his character that drew you into his story as well?
I did try very hard to make sure that the male characters were well represented. I do think as a female writer, I find it more difficult to really get inside the head of a male character. And I was very conscious about not making it too female focused. I know in Australia, fantasy tends to be seen as almost a woman's genre. I know that there are a lot of female writers in Australia. A lot of the publishers have an awful lot of women represented, and I know this is somewhat unusual in the global marketplace. I know that in America, fantasy is considered a boys' club, and I really wanted to make sure that I wasn't blocking anyone out of the story by focusing too much on one or the other. I really did try to put in a gender balance, basically.
I found it, as a male reader, I mean, I'm obviously, you're on a podcast that's got a feminist sort of approach, but and I'm a fairly balanced sort of reader in terms of, you know, wanting to make sure that I do read quite a few female authors. I would say you've done quite a good job of that. I find there were moments in this book that were quite dark, so and realist, I thought. So it's certainly, yeah, I wouldn't think that anyone would be turned off by having a female author's name on the page. But then again, you don't know how people are trained to read.
I was going to say that one of the things that I do, I rely on my beta readers a lot, my male beta readers, to make sure that I'm on the right track when it comes to male characters and male dialogue especially. I find that men tend to talk differently to the way women do. And so if I've got two female characters talking, the conversation will be quite different than if it's two male characters talking or a female character talking to a male character. And that's even on top of the particular idiosyncrasies of how one character will communicate as opposed to another one. So it gets a little bit complicated at times. I do rely a lot on my beta readers for feedback.
Well, you've got some good male beta readers, obviously, because, I think it's come out as a very even book in that regard. I did mention just previously there that the Norma K. Hemming Award, and for our international listeners, that's for works exploring race, gender, sexuality, class and disability in Australian speculative fiction. And you shared that nomination with people like Margot Lanigan, Kate Forsyth and Rowena Corey Daniels, all favourite authors of mine, mind you. Your story features a disabled warrior, Isidro, a man who has been tortured and raped and had his identity as a warrior destroyed through disfigurement. I just wondered what drew you to exploring these aspects of his character, particularly the disability.
I am disabled myself. I have rheumatoid arthritis, and the character of Isidro came to me at the time when I was applying for disability pension, which is really not a pleasant process to go through. Basically, you've got to go and convince the government basically that you can't be a fully functioning member of society. It's just very, very dehumanising process. And when I was going through this, I just really wanted to read a book about someone like me who is facing all these issues and trying to find a place for himself in society where all of the things that he feels make him a valuable person in his world have kind of been taken away, and he has to rebuild his identity and find a way to move forward in his society.
I thought that came through particularly well. One thing that did strike me particularly about Winter Be My Shield was the weather and its interaction with place. In particular, that it was more than just flavouring. And I was very conscious of the weather and change of seasons as being a motivating factor in the story, particularly around tactics of certain armies and that sort of thing. And I was interested, being from a virtually snowless South Australia, what drew you to this fantasy set in the frozen north, and what sort of research would you have had to have done?
The thing that drew me to the cold climate, very early on when I was putting the story together, I basically just had the three characters. I had Sierra, Cam and Isidro. And one of the first things that I really knew about them all was that they needed to live somewhere cold, somewhere like they needed to live in an extreme environment. It took me a long time to figure out why this was the case, but I realised it's because the extreme cold and a very harsh and dangerous environment forces the characters to work together, even when they'd rather not. You know, they really have to rely on each other. They have to rely on people they wouldn't necessarily have an alliance with if they didn't need it for survival. It really forces people to work together despite the interpersonal conflicts, despite conflicting goals and motivations, and this is something that carries on really throughout the series. The research is one thing that I really love to talk about because I love research. It's my it's the hangover from my science degree. I just love reading and like assembling all the information I can get my hands on basically about whatever it is that I'm working on. And the research just I spent an awful long time pulling out things about, you know, treks through Siberia in the early 1900s, information about native peoples who live in the subarctic, stories about people who go and live like in a cabin in the woods in North America. There's some really wonderful books out there like that. Just anything I could get my hands on that dealt with living in cold climates in low-tech conditions, basically. And it's just enormous amount of fun going in and really immersing yourself in all that stuff.
Now, I've read that you plan rather than just sit down and write. So when it comes to doing the research, I gather you start with your plan first and then you go, all right, I need to know about this area.
To some extent, but I find that just doing the research in the first place put me in mind of gave me a lot of information that then informed the story and set out how things would take place in the story, things that you wouldn't necessarily occur to you would be a problem until you've done all the research and understand what some of the hazards are of living in this environment. For example, in book one, there's a fight scene that happens on a river that's frozen over and starting to thaw. And a lot of that came out of a book about hiking in winter conditions. I think it's called The Snowwalker's Companion, talking about hiking along frozen rivers and what are the danger signs to look out for and the natural processes that occur in these environments. And it was reading that that really made that whole scene coalesce for me, really. So it's I think two processes go hand in hand a lot of the time.
I did attend a workshop with Fiona McIntosh, and she was describing her writing plan was basically she just sat down and wrote for 3 to 4 hours, hit a word count each day, and then went off and sort of had the rest of her life and did that for about 17, 18 weeks of the year to do a book. And I was just wondering, you obviously plan, but what's your writing setup or your plan for getting the book down on paper?
Because of my arthritis, I was a disability pensioner for a long time. I've never quite managed to have a conventional career. It's just not something that's worked out for me. So writing, working on books is something, is my main focus, that what I spend the bulk of my time and energy on. I usually work for about 2.5 hours a day. I usually aim for 2,000 words, and when that's done or when I'm just too tired to keep going, I'm almost there. That's what I usually go for each day. But to start with, I'll sit down with a notepad and usually just write out a couple of pages worth of notes just to get everything straight in my head to what I'm writing about that day. And it's kind of infuriating because I keep doing this and then I never look at them again. They're just out in a drawer. And it's like I just kind of need that process to get everything laid out, but then I may as well just go and throw them away. But I can't quite bring myself to do it, so I have this enormous stack of notepaper. It's filling up drawers in the house. But, yeah, I do that generally 2 hours a day, 2,000 words, but I end up writing an hell of a lot more than 180,000 words to get a manuscript. I always overshoot to at least 200,000 words, and then when it comes around to editing, I've got to cut it right back. So it's not a straightforward process by any stretch of the imagination.
I like quizzing writers on, I suppose, call it idiosyncrasies, if that's not too rude a word or way to put it. In a podcast that we've got coming up, Margot Lanigan talks about handwriting out her stories, her short stories, and how that process is different to just typing out on a computer, the thinking process and the flow of information comes out. So it's always interesting to hear that, you know, a writer might go and write, you know, 2 pages of notes and then sort of never refer to them. But obviously, like you say, it's an integral part of your creative process.
That's right. I always say that there's some problems can only be solved with a pen in the hand. Sometimes I can't think unless I'm holding a pen. That's just the way my brain works sometimes.
So a sort of a situational a key to unlocking creativity.
Sometimes, I think, yeah.
The other thing that struck me, apart from the weather being, you know, a significant part, lots of stories, lots of fantasy can just include sort of snowscapes and you don't really have that effect of the environment. But the other thing that really struck me with Winter Be My Shield was the very visual way you described the magic, particularly when it comes to the blood magic, so Sierra and Raston. I wondered, when you were constructing your world, what sort of influenced you to present magic in that way?
It's hard to say. It's difficult to say this as a scientist because it doesn't quite make sense, but magic has to make sense to me in the context of the story. Magic always has to follow rules in fantasy novels, and the way it comes to me, I always tend to imagine it something along the lines of chi, of the internal energy. And I don't know, that always comes to me as a very visual thing, but it's just the way it's kind of worked out that it's easier to I think, describe these things as you visualize them than to make it a more internal thing, I suppose. It's hard to say exactly why it came out the way that it did.
I found that probably out of reading that book, those were the two things that struck me, the magic and the environment. Moving on to, I wanted to ask you where you thought your series sat George Martin and Joe Abercrombie, just to pick two names that are frequently used in relation to this, they get credit and flack for producing what's termed grim, dark or gritty cynical fantasy or fantasy with shades of grey. And I was wondering where you thought the Black Sun series might sit in relation to that description. And I ask it because I find that your characters and their motivations are every bit as real, every bit as grey, motivated by self-interest rather than, you know, your black and white good and evil.
I have no problem at all with it being regarded as dark and gritty fantasy. That really is what I set out to write, trying to get away from the very traditional kind of very heroic fantasy of you know, that is very black and white and good and evil. I just think that there is more going on in the real world, in a real story than what I was reading when I was, you know, 11 or 12, reading a lot of the 80s and early 90s fantasy. I do really enjoy reading a lot of the very, very dark and gritty fantasy that's out there. I think the big difference for me so far, at least, is that my characters are not as grey as some characters, I think. My main characters certainly have, while they're motivated by self-interest, they're trying to stay alive in these situations, they're trying to survive. They are, in a lot of cases, not all cases, not willing to do anything to stay alive, although that sort of thing does change throughout the course of the story.
I would tend to agree there. I think probably struck a good balance between seeing characters that we could see walking down the street, the types of people around us in the book, as opposed to opportunists everywhere, which is what I seem to find when I'm reading Martin or Abercrombie. There's certainly...
Opportunist is a good way to put it. Yeah. I've got some characters who will take any opportunity that presents that's presented to them. But some of them really are trying to hold on to a set of core values, even though it seems like the world around them is trying to strip those away.
I could see myself being in a room with several of the characters in your story, maybe not Raston and Kel, but and not being too concerned. But I'd be very very worried about my back if I was among the characters in Game of Thrones or Joe Abercrombie's work. So sticking with that realist approach, the history of Winter Be My Shield and the subsequent books that have come out or coming out features genocide against magic users, and there's a presentation of competing versions of history. And I wondered if there was anything in particular that inspired the exploration of this concept of hidden histories or suppressed histories.
It's really just the idea that history is written by the victors. Actually, a lot of this has probably come about with researching women's history, and we tend to get told, or the history books rather, present history as being populated by men, and it's the men who are doing everything. And it's simply not true, because there were a lot of women throughout history who had very powerful roles, the real movers and shakers. They just tend to get written out of it, out of the books, out of history. Unless you really go hunting and you really know where to look, then you start to see these things popping up that are just never mentioned in a lot of texts. And I think that's really where it came from, the idea that what you see written down of history is not necessarily what happened, it's just one version of events. And the people who are writing it these days might, you know, probably don't necessarily know that what they're presenting is incomplete, because what's happened in the past has been hidden so well that you're, unless you really, really go looking for it, it's just never going to show up. So I just really like the idea of always more than one story back there. You've just got to go hunting for it.
There's been a bit of a discussion on Twitter lately about book covers, especially the presentation of women. In fact, I think that there probably isn't a month that doesn't go by where there's some comment on the way that women are being presented in fantasy or in speculative fiction. And looking here at a copy of Winter Be My Shield, I notice that it's delightfully gender neutral. In presenting or emphasising the environment, if anything. And I wondered, how much input did you have in cover selection? And I wonder also what fantasy covers appeal to you?
I count myself very lucky to be published by HarperCollins. They've been very good in asking for and accepting input into cover ideas. When I first signed the contract and we started talking about cover art, Stephanie Smith, who was the publisher at Voyager at the time, asked me if I had any ideas. I ended up assembling a big pile of pictures that I always come across pictures in my research, and I always like to save them to look back because there's a lot of information you can get from them that you don't necessarily get from the text, just in terms of flavour and feeling and, you know, a sense of the place that you're researching. And so I dug through all of those, and the one that they've used on the cover, the hooded figure that's used on the cover of Winter Be My Shield, is one of the pictures that I sent them. So I was very pleased to see that one used. And it is meant to be Sierra on the front cover there. You can tell because of the long hair hanging out.
The long hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking, it strikes me that sometimes when I go into a bookstore and I'll see a book by an author that I read and that I love, and I look at the cover and I'm immediately turned off and as a male reader because of the presentation of the work, and that's just something that I can't control. And what I thought HarperCollins have done very well with this is create a book that should work well, I think, with male readers, because I look at the cover and go, oh, that's interesting. I can see swirls of sort of pictograms in the bottom of the page and a shield and this brutally cold environment. And if I was particularly averse to reading stories about women, I probably wouldn't notice the gender of the person on the front of the book. Not the author, of course, but the person in the picture. So what sort of covers do you find appeal to you in that regard in fantasy?
I do like the photographic covers that are coming through. They're a lot more popular these days. Beyond that, I don't know, it's really hard to quantify. It's usually the quality of the artwork that draws me. I have to say, when they were asking for ideas, I had some pictures of other book covers that I quite liked, and they tended to be the illustrated covers. And with those ones, it tends to be often the landscape and the setting. I like to see the depth in the setting and also relationships between the characters. It's not something you tend to see very often on front covers, because often they're a single character, or like one of the styles that's been very popular lately is, you know, the single figure on a white cover, whether it's the whole figure or just the face or half the face. You see those a lot, and you tend not to get any sense of relationship in those covers. I tend to find that the ones that do show that well always tend to draw my attention.
Interesting. I always like looking at different covers between the US and the UK, or because our covers tend to be the same as the UK covers, but just there's an interesting divide there in the types of covers you can get, dependent on the culture that they're being sold to.
That's true. It is quite interesting, yeah, to see how those crop up.
Now, we're nearing the end of the questions. I've got one more for you. The Children of the Black Sun series has been optioned for film. It happened earlier in this year, I believe. And yeah, while optioning a film or optioning a book for a film won't guarantee that a film will be made, it's, you know, the first step on a long road. And I wondered how you felt when you got the news and if that affected your writing in any way?
It hasn't affected my writing. I'm currently working on book three and just trying to get it finished off. So it was mostly written by that point. And yeah, it hasn't changed much of what I'm trying to do. I think possibly because I'm so far through the series, if it had come earlier, it might have made a bit more of a difference. But I do know that there are some aspects of the story would be extremely problematic to get through Hollywood, so I know that you know, if it does come to that point, there will be some changes made. As to how I felt, it's just really, I guess, gratifying to know that people see so much potential in it, because I've never really envisioned it as anything more than the books. You know, that's really been the extent of my vision, just because that's my focus as a writer, is to just produce the books. So for someone else who really works extensively in another medium to see this and see something that he wants to make from it, because I really see it as these books are my work and anything that's made from them are someone else's vision, and they're someone else's way of exploring my story with their own kind of medium. Just to know that someone else finds it interesting enough and want to go into that much depth with the work is really gratifying.
Well, It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Joe. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity, and I'd like to wish you good luck with Black Sun Light My Way.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.